right now, your body is probably holding on to this like massive knot of resentment.
Oh, almost certainly.
Yeah, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's for that favor you agreed to do like 3 weeks ago.
Right.
You know the feeling. Your jaw is just tight, your stomach drops every single time you look at your calendar, and you are just exhausted before the day even begins.
It's a horrible feeling.
It really is. And well, statistically speaking, based on the clinical research we're about to unpack today, the reason you said yes to that favor wasn't actually out of the goodness of your heart.
No, it
It was
wasn't.
a trauma response.
Which is, that is a really heavy realization for a lot of people to swallow.
Oh, for sure.
We often, we dress up our inability to say no as generosity, like we're just being kind. But in reality, it's a deeply ingrained survival mechanism.
Right.
We are just completely terrified of the friction that comes with holding a personal limit.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, our mission is to basically extract the most vital, actionable insights from this massive stack of clinical frameworks.
It's a lot of material.
It really is. We've got therapeutic worksheets, psychological research, and it is all focused on one incredibly challenging and honestly universally misunderstood topic.
Setting personal boundaries.
Exactly. Setting boundaries. We are taking this absolute mountain of source material and turning it into a roadmap for you, the listener.
Because frankly, if you are tired of pouring from an empty cup, this is the information that actually stops the leak.
So true. And what's really fascinating here is how the research completely flips our cultural understanding of what a boundary actually is.
Yeah, that's the biggest takeaway right off the bat. Author and researcher Dr. Brené Brown articulates this beautifully in the source material.
Oh, I love her work on this.
It's brilliant. We usually think of boundaries as defensive walls.
Right, like a fortress.
Exactly. But her research suggests boundaries are not walls designed to keep people out. They are actually roadmaps for keeping people in.
Okay, let's unpack this immediately
Yeah.
because that is a massive paradigm shift.
It really changes how you view relationships.
It does. Because when I hear the word boundary, my brain instantly pictures a giant stone fortress wall.
Complete with a moat.
Right. A moat, maybe some alligators. Like you are either safely inside my wall or you are banished to the wilderness.
Yeah, it feels very absolute.
It feels harsh. So, I mean, how is a boundary a roadmap to keep someone in?
Well, think about it like this. A fortress wall isolates you, but a roadmap guides the relationship.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Think of a boundary not as a brick wall, but as the invisible lines that define what is acceptable and what is not in your
Was
interactions.
it rules of the road?
Precisely. They are the rules of engagement that allow a relationship to exist safely and sustainably over the long term.
Sustainable. That's the key.
Right, because without them, we don't have true connection. We basically just have either enmeshment or we have resentment.
Okay, wait, let's pause on that word. Enmeshment, because that sounds, very clinical, like clinical jargon. For the listener who might confuse enmeshment with just being like really close to someone, what is the actual clinical difference there?
That is a crucial distinction to make. Being close to someone means two distinct individuals are choosing to walk side by side.
Okay.
You have your feelings, they have theirs, and you support each other.
Two separate people.
Exactly. Enmeshment, on the other hand, is when those two individuals bleed into one another like wet
Oh,
watercolors.
wow. That's a vivid image.
You basically lose the physical and emotional sensation of where your identity ends and the other person's begins.
So you're just totally absorbed.
Yeah. If they are anxious, you automatically become anxious. If they are angry, you feel completely responsible for fixing it.
Like it's your fault.
Right. You cannot regulate your own emotions independent of theirs.
Which sounds exhausting.
It's wildly exhausting,
Yeah.
and boundaries are the cure for enmeshment.
How so?
They are a life-enhancing system of yes and no. And that system allows you to safely express who you are without being consumed by someone else.
So it's almost like if having porous boundaries is like having a house with no insulation, right?
I love this analogy.
Where you're spending all your internal energy trying to heat the whole neighborhood,
Yes.
and you're just wondering why you're still freezing to death inside your own house.
Exactly.
So setting a boundary is basically just putting up insulation. It's drawing a property line and putting up a welcome sign that says, here are the house rules so we can actually enjoy our time together.
The insulation analogy is perfect because it speaks directly to energy preservation.
Right.
And if we connect this back to the bigger picture, These house rules are critical for creating healthy relationships because they protect your emotional and physical well-being.
Which the research heavily supports.
Oh, the clinical literature is unanimous on this. When we don't set boundaries, we experience a very slow, toxic buildup of resentment.
It's that simmering anger.
Yeah, we take on way more than we can handle, which leads to chronic burnout. So setting a boundary is not an act of selfishness at all.
It's not.
Not even a little. It is the ultimate act of self-care and mutual respect.
Mutual respect. I like that.
It's you saying to someone, I value this relationship enough to tell you how to safely be in it with me so that I don't eventually end up hating you.
Wow. So I can either set a boundary now or hate you later.
That's essentially the choice.
Which brings us to, I mean, really the central tension of this whole deep dive.
Let's get into it.
Let's be totally real. If boundaries are this beautiful roadmap, and if they're supposed to make our lives so much better,
yeah,
why does saying a simple no, like just no, to helping a friend move on a Saturday, why does that make me want to fake my own death to avoid the guilt?
It really does feel that intense.
It does. Why do boundaries feel so utterly terrifying to implement?
Well, to understand how to build boundaries, we first have to unpack the profound psychological barriers that stop us from setting them in the first place.
The internal roadblocks.
Exactly. It comes down to our internal programming. The clinical frameworks we're looking at point to three core reasons why our boundaries fail.
Okay, what are they?
The fear of rejection, the fear of confrontation, and that deep-seated guilt you just mentioned. The fear of being labeled selfish.
It's that classic people-pleasing reflex.
It is.
But where does it actually come from? Like, why is the guilt so physically crushing in those moments?
Because people-pleasers operate under a deeply flawed but very unconscious assumption about their own value.
Okay, what's the assumption?
They believe their worth is inextricably tied to how much they sacrifice for others.
Oh, man. That hits close to home.
Right. And this often starts in early development, childhood.
Like how we were raised.
Exactly. If you were only praised when you were quiet, accommodating, or helpful, your brain literally wires itself to believe that compliance equals safety and love.
So if I'm not helping, I'm not safe.
You've got it. If you aren't giving, fixing, or accommodating, you fear you are fundamentally unlovable. And the sources show that this constant self-abandonment eventually leads to severe anxiety and irritability.
That makes total sense. So if we look at this culturally, because our sources highlight a really fascinating cultural example of this exact dynamic.
Oh, yes. The Seattle Nice phenomenon.
Right. So if this behavior shows how avoidance destroys societal trust, how does it manifest individually?
Well, Seattle Nice is a perfect macro-level example of boundary failure disguised as politeness.
Okay, for you listening, if you live in or visit Seattle, there is a documented culture where people are superficially incredibly friendly.
Very pleasant on the surface.
Exactly. But they are absolutely terrified of direct communication or confrontation.
Terrified.
So Seattle Nice relies heavily on indirect no's. Let's look at an example. Say two coworkers, Dave and Sarah, are talking.
Okay, Dave and Sarah.
Dave invites Sarah to a weekend barbecue. Now, Sarah absolutely does not want to go. She needs to rest.
She's exhausted.
Right. But instead of setting a gentle boundary and saying, you know, I can't make it. I need a quiet weekend.
What does she do?
She says, oh, that sounds great. I'll try to make it.
The classic fake yes.
Exactly. And then she spends the next 3 days dodging Dave in the hallway, making vague excuses, and ultimately just ghosting him entirely.
Because in her mind, setting a direct boundary is mean.
Yes. She thinks saying no is inherently cruel.
And we have to really look at the fallout of that behavior.
Yeah.
Because Sarah thinks she's preserving the relationship by avoiding the discomfort of saying no.
Right. She thinks she's keeping the peace.
But the irony is that this conflict avoidance actually destroys trust.
It does.
It creates what the sources refer to as the Seattle freeze.
The Seattle freeze.
Yeah. Which is a social environment where everyone is exceedingly polite, but relationships remain stubbornly on the surface.
Nobody actually connects.
Right. People use distance and pleasantries as a shield. So in your example, Dave doesn't think Sarah is nice.
What does he think?
Dave thinks Sarah is flaky and unreliable.
Ouch.
And Sarah thinks Dave is overly demanding for constantly inviting her to things.
Wow, so they both end up miserable.
Exactly. They both end up alienated simply because they lack the tools for honest, direct boundary setting.
It's so true. A clear, direct no is just so much kinder than a fake yes followed by a ghosting.
It respects the other person's reality.
It really does. But there's another psychological barrier to setting boundaries in the research, and honestly, this one absolutely stopped me in my tracks.
I know exactly which one you mean.
It comes from Dr. John Gottman's research on relationships.
Yes.
He introduces this idea that setting boundaries almost always triggers grief.
Yeah, and this is where the psychological work gets incredibly deep.
Grief, though.
It raises an important question about what we are actually letting go of when we set a limit.
I have to admit, I want to push back on this a little
bit.
Not
for it.
Because grief, like if I tell my coworker to stop interrupting me in meetings, or I tell my friend I can't help them move, I'm not grieving anything.
You're not crying over it.
No, I'm just annoyed. So can you explain how grief actually plays into this?
Well, you're totally right that telling a coworker to stop interrupting doesn't trigger profound mourning.
Okay, good.
But Gottman is talking about the macro boundaries, the foundational relationships in our lives.
Like family or partners.
Exactly. Think about setting a firm boundary with someone who continuously hurts you, drains you, or chronically fails to meet your needs.
Right. Like a toxic parent, maybe.
A toxic parent, an emotionally unavailable partner, or even a deeply narcissistic friend.
Okay, see.
When you finally draw a hard line with them, you have to face a very cold, hard reality.
You have to accept that they aren't going to change.
Exactly. That's the painful part. We often avoid setting boundaries because as long as we are just making requests or complaining to them, we can secretly hold on to a fantasy.
A fantasy.
The fantasy that the other person will eventually wake up, realize their mistakes, and give us what we want.
Oh, like if I just explain it one more time.
Yes. We think if I just explain it one more time, they'll finally love me the right way. But enforcing a boundary, actually saying, I will not engage with you when you speak to me that way, and then actually leaving the room, forces us to accept the reality of who that person is right now.
Not who we want them to be.
Right. You are grieving the illusion of control.
Mourning the illusion of control.
Yeah. You are mourning the relationship you desperately wished you had in order to protect yourself from the relationship you actually have.
Wow. That is heavy. You are giving up the hope of a better past or this magical future and dealing with the reality of the present.
It hurts. It really does.
But it explains so much of the internal resistance we feel. So because cultural conditioning, this ingrained people-pleasing, and this underlying hidden grief cloud our judgments so heavily.
Right.
The source material suggests we can't just start throwing the word no around randomly.
No, we need a strategy.
We have to systematically audit our current boundary styles. Like,
yeah,
we have to figure out exactly where the insulation is missing in our house before we can patch it.
It requires a really fearless personal inventory.
So how do we do that?
Well, the clinical literature conceptualizes boundaries along a structural continuum. We can basically look at three main profiles.
Let's evaluate these profiles. Because on one extreme, we have the fortress, and on the other extreme, we have the doormat.
Right. So let's start with the fortress, which the clinical texts call rigid boundaries.
Rigid boundaries.
Okay. Someone with rigid boundaries lives in an emotional bunker.
Just totally closed off.
Exactly. They consistently keep everyone at arm's length. They are highly reluctant to share feelings. They rarely ask for help. And they maintain strict, impenetrable walls.
It's the person who turns down every single social invite or just cuts people off at the very first sign of a disagreement.
The infamous door slam.
Yes. And not because they are genuinely busy or incompatible, but because the mere idea of vulnerability is terrifying to them.
Right.
They'd rather be the one doing the rejecting before they can be rejected.
Precisely. It's an extreme protective measure. And very often, it is actually an untreated trauma response.
That makes sense.
Now, while rigid boundaries absolutely prevent you from getting hurt or exploited by others, they carry a massive, devastating cost.
Which is?
They guarantee isolation. You are safe from attack, but you are entirely alone.
Okay, so on the total opposite end of the spectrum, we have porous boundaries.
The doormat.
Right. This is the house with no doors and no insulation whatsoever.
Yes. With porous boundaries, an individual has an almost absolute inability to say no.
Like physically cannot say it.
Pretty much. They take on everyone else's problems as if they were their own, which goes right back to that concept of enmeshment we discussed.
The bleeding watercolors.
Exactly. They tend to overshare highly personal details very quickly with strangers, and they tolerate abuse or disrespect simply to avoid the friction of conflict.
The classic example of this is agreeing to take on a massive project at work when you are already drowning.
Oh, happens all the time.
Simply because disappointing your boss feels worse than your own physical suffering. You have just abandoned yourself entirely.
Which leads us to the synthesis we are actually striving for here. healthy boundaries.
The middle ground.
Yes, the balanced middle ground. Healthy boundaries are firm enough to protect your peace, your energy, and your self-respect.
But they aren't walls.
Right. They are flexible enough to allow for deep, meaningful connection and vulnerability. You can communicate clearly, express emotions comfortably, and prioritize your own well-being without that crushing guilt.
So we have the three structural profiles. But the research gets even more granular than that.
It does. It gets very specific.
It breaks boundaries down into six specific domains. So it's not just one big, vague concept.
It's highly compartmentalized.
And instead of just reading these six domains off a list like a textbook index, let's actually look at how they play out in real life.
Okay, let's do a scenario.
Let's imagine a scenario that I think a lot of listeners will find intensely, maybe painfully, relatable. A chaotic family holiday weekend.
Oh, boy. A perfect crucible for boundary testing.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving. So you walk through the front door for a family Thanksgiving. Immediately, your Aunt Brenda rushes up and gives you a suffocating 5-minute hug, even though she knows you hate being touched.
We all have an Aunt Brenda.
Right.
Yeah.
So which domain is this?
That is a direct violation of physical boundaries.
Physical.
Yes. This domain relates to your body, your personal space, and even your right to rest.
Okay.
It dictates who can touch you, how close someone can stand to you, or whether someone can just walk into your bedroom without knocking.
Oh, the knocking thing is huge.
Huge. A healthy physical boundary in that Aunt Brenda moment might be taking a step back, offering a hand, and saying, "It's so good to see you, Aunt Brenda, but I'm not much of a hugger today."
Okay, so you survive Aunt Brenda, mm-hmm. You sit down on the couch, and immediately your mother corners you.
Of course she does.
And she spends the next 2 hours explicitly detailing every single flaw in her marriage with your father, completely dumping all her unresolved trauma onto you.
That brings us to the second domain, emotional boundaries. This one is enormous, especially in families. Emotional boundaries are about your capacity to listen to others' problems without taking on their emotional baggage.
Like being their therapist.
Exactly. And conversely, it's about not dumping your own unprocessed emotions onto someone else without checking if they even have the capacity to hear it.
So in this case,
your mother is violating your emotional boundary by using you as a therapist without your consent.
Right. And you sit there and take it because she's your mom, which is a porous emotional boundary.
Exactly.
Okay, next. You escape to the kitchen. And your Uncle Bob decides to corner you about your career choices.
Oh, no.
He is openly mocking the industry you work in, calling your beliefs naive, just really laying into you.
This is a breach of intellectual boundaries.
Intellectual. Interesting.
Yeah, this domain is about mutual respect for differing thoughts, ideas, and curiosities.
It's not about agreeing, right?
No, not at all. It means you can have a conversation or even a passionate debate without someone belittling, mocking, or attacking your core intelligence.
Okay, that makes sense.
If someone attacks your character simply because of a differing opinion, that is an intellectual boundary violation.
Good to know. So then your cousin pulls you aside. They've mismanaged their money again. And they ask you for a quote-unquote small loan of $500 to cover their rent.
Ah, the family loan.
And they're making you feel immensely guilty if you don't help family out.
Domain number four, material or financial boundaries.
Financial.
This is all about your possessions and your money. It involves setting limits on loaning cash, sharing your car, or protecting the peace and integrity of your physical belongings.
Okay, so you dodge the cousin, but then an older relative starts loudly asking why you aren't married yet, asking deeply intrusive questions about your dating life and your biological clock.
Oof, that touches on sexual and intimacy boundaries.
That feels so invasive.
It is. This domain encompasses consent, safety, and mutual understanding of physical desires. But it also heavily includes the right to keep your intimate life private.
Like none of your business.
Exactly. It's the absolute right to say my romantic life is not up for public discussion today.
Finally, it's like 4:00 p.m. You are exhausted. You announce you are going to head home, and your father gets furious.
Because of course he does.
He demands you stay until late into the night. Because family stays until the end, completely ignoring the fact that you have a massive presentation for work the next morning.
The sixth and final domain, time boundaries.
Time.
How you allocate and value the hours in your day. This means preventing others from monopolizing your schedule, setting strict limits on how long you will engage in certain activities.
Even family activities.
Especially family activities. It's valuing your time as a finite, precious resource.
So we have Physical, emotional, intellectual, material, intimacy, and time boundaries.
Those are the six.
But here's a major roadblock. Like, knowing I have a porous time boundary at Thanksgiving doesn't magically give me the courage to fix it.
Awareness is not action.
Exactly. The source material is very clear on this. In the heat of the moment, when Uncle Bob is yelling or Mama's crying, our nervous system just panics.
We go straight into fight, flight, or freeze.
Yes. My throat closes up. My heart pounds. I can't think straight.
Yeah.
So how do we literally train our bodies and minds to feel safe enough to actually hold a line?
This is perhaps the most crucial part of this entire deep dive.
I think so too.
Because if we don't address the body, the words will never come out. The clinical frameworks provide a highly practical toolkit based on the understanding that setting a boundary is deeply physiological before it is ever verbal.
Wait, can you explain the mechanism there? Why does my body react to an intrusive question about my dating life the same way it would react to, like, a physical threat, a bear attacking me?
It's an amygdala hijack.
Amygdala hijack.
Yes. The amygdala is the part of your brain that processes fear and threat. For someone with a history of people-pleasing, setting a boundary or facing someone's disappointment registers in the brain as a literal threat to survival.
Because of what we talked about earlier.
Right. Because your brain learned that non-compliance meant rejection, and rejection meant you weren't safe.
Wow.
So your amygdala floods your body with cortisol and adrenaline. Your rational brain, the prefrontal cortex, which handles logic and speech, literally goes offline.
Shuts down.
Totally shuts down. You cannot communicate effectively if your nervous system is dysregulated. So we have to start with somatic or body-based exercises to hack the nervous system and bring the rational brain back online.
Let's focus heavily on these step-by-step guidelines, because this is where the clinical theory actually turns into a daily practice.
Right.
The first somatic exercise comes from practitioner Rachel Fernley. It's called somatic tapping.
Yes. This is a grounding practice designed to help you physically feel the edges of yourself.
Edges.
Remember enmeshment. When we are enmeshed with others, we literally lose the physical sensation of where we end, and the other person begins in moments of high stress.
The bleeding watercolors again.
Right. Somatic tapping forces the brain to recognize the physical container of your body.
Okay. Here is the step-by-step guide from the source. First, stand up if you are able or sit comfortably. And you begin by gently tapping the top of your head with your fingertips.
Right. And you don't tap hard, just enough to actually feel the tactile sensation.
Okay, before we go to the next step, how does tapping my head actually change the chemical panic happening in my brain when my boss is yelling at me?
It's all about sensory input. When you tap your skin, you are stimulating the mechanoreceptors.
Mechanoreceptors.
Yeah, the nerve endings in your skin. These send immediate, tangible signals to your brain that say, I am here, I am solid, I am physically safe in this exact moment.
So it pulls you into the present.
Exactly. It acts as a physiological interrupt button for the panic loop in your amygdala. It stimulates the vagus nerve, which engages your parasympathetic nervous system.
Which is the calm down system.
Right, the rest and digest mode.
That makes so much sense. It grounds the electricity. So as you are performing this physical tapping, you slowly move down your body. From your head to your face, your neck, your shoulders, down your arms to your fingertips. And as you do this, you repeat a specific set of mantras, either out loud or in your mind.
The words are very important.
You say, this is my body. These are my emotions. What I feel is valid.
And you keep tapping down your chest, your pelvis, down your legs, all the way to your toes, continually repeating those phrases.
This is my body. These are my emotions.
Exactly. You are establishing an intellectual boundary alongside the physical one.
Okay, step three. Once you reach your feet, you pause.
Yeah.
Then you bring your hands back up to your head, and instead of tapping, you use sweeping motions.
Like brushing off.
Right. You sweep your hands down over your body, brushing down your arms, your torso, your legs, while repeating, this is my body, these are my boundaries, these are my sensations.
Yes.
Finally, you shake your hands and arms out, take a deep breath in, and let it out.
It's a full physiological reset. It stops the porous emotional leaking by reminding your nervous system that you are a separate, contained entity.
I love that. The second somatic practice is even more visceral. It comes from sensor-motor psychotherapy, and it's called the tangible boundary exercise.
This one is incredibly powerful.
This actually involves physically building a boundary.
It does. Step one, find an open space on the floor and sit down.
Okay.
Step two, gather physical objects from around your house, ropes, thick strings, scarves, or even couch pillows.
Whatever you have on hand.
Right. Step three, physically construct a ring around your body using these objects. You are building a tangible, symbolic boundary that you can actually see and touch.
Now, I can hear a listener right now thinking, this sounds a bit silly, sitting in a pillow fort on my living room floor.
It can feel a little silly at first.
But the instructions emphasize that you must really take your time with this and be intentional. You adjust the distance.
Yes, the distance is key.
Maybe you want the rope 3 feet away from you in the front, but right up against your back. Why are we doing this?
Because of visuospatial processing. Your brain constantly maps your relationship to the physical space around you.
It's always scanning.
Right. By physically building a wall, you adjust the thickness and the shape until it feels somatically right.
Oh, I see.
If you feel vulnerable behind you, you stack extra pillows behind your back. If you feel exposed on your left side, you double up the scarves there. You are giving your brain a physical representation of safety.
So, step four. Once the boundary is built, you sit quietly in the space you have defined. And you just monitor your body.
Just pay attention.
You pay attention to your breathing. Does it get deeper? Does your posture naturally straighten up? Does the tension in your jaw or your shoulders melt away when your space is physically protected?
The purpose here is to create a physical anchor memory.
An anchor memory.
Yes. When you experience that bodily relief inside the rope circle, your brain records what safety feels like.
Okay, so how does that help later?
Later, when you are at work and a coworker invades your physical space or makes an unreasonable demand,
you're panicked.
You're panicked, but you can mentally recall the feeling of sitting inside that thick physical boundary. That memory helps calm your nervous system just enough to allow you to speak up.
That is brilliant. It's like a mental shield you carry with you.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've hacked the nervous system. The body is grounded. Now we move to the cognitive and journaling exercises to get our minds right before we have a difficult conversation.
Right, the mental prep.
The first one from the source material is values alignment.
This is a crucial cognitive step because it removes the guilt from setting a boundary.
Which is the biggest hurdle.
It really is. A boundary isn't just some arbitrary rule you create to be difficult or mean. It should be the proactive defense of your core values.
Okay.
So step one of this exercise is to identify your top core values. Things like family, health, honesty, autonomy, or peace.
Let's use the example from the text because I think it's so clear. Let's say you do the journaling. And you decide your core value is health.
Okay, health is the value.
But you look at your daily habits and realize you routinely answer non-urgent work emails at 11.00 p.m., totally destroying your sleep cycle.
Very common.
You have just identified what the text calls a boundary gap.
Exactly. You are living out of alignment with your own stated values. The anxiety you feel isn't just about the emails.
It's not.
No, it's the cognitive dissonance of betraying yourself.
Oh, betraying yourself. That's a strong way to put it.
But it's true. So step two is creating a boundary to close that gap. For instance, you say, I will not check my work email after 8.0 p.m.
And here's the magic trick of this exercise. When you connect the boundary directly to your core value of health, it transforms the action in your mind.
Completely transforms.
It goes from being an act of selfishness or letting your boss down into an act of profound personal integrity.
Yes.
You aren't saying no to your boss. You are saying yes to your health.
That reframing changes everything. It gives you the moral fortitude to actually withstand the pushback you're going to get.
The next cognitive exercise is a journaling practice from the Center for Growth called the Boundary Circle.
This one is about mechanics.
Right. It's about getting totally clear on the mechanics of your boundary before you ever open your mouth.
It's a three-step journaling process. Step one, define what you need to feel safe emotionally, physically, or mentally.
And you must be highly specific.
Incredibly specific. Do not write something vague like, I need people to be nicer to me.
Right. That means nothing.
Write something like, I need to not be yelled at or called names during disagreements in order to feel emotionally safe.
Okay. Step two is critical. Set the consequences.
Without a consequence, a boundary is nothing.
Because if a boundary has no consequence, it's not a boundary, it's just a suggestion.
Exactly. Just a preference.
So you write down exactly what you will do if the line is crossed. For example, if my partner yells at me, I will immediately leave the room and not return for at least an hour.
And then step three, write a declaration of empowerment. Yes. A personal mantra to remind yourself why this matters. Something like, I honor my limits in interpersonal relationships because I deserve to feel emotionally safe in my own home.
Why do we have to write it down?
You write this down so that when your resolve wavers, and trust me, it will waver, you have a written logical record of your own truth to refer back to.
Another great visual exercise mentioned in the worksheets is your circles.
Oh, I use this one all the time.
You draw concentric circles on a piece of paper. You are in the very center.
Right.
The innermost circle is reserved for the people who get intimate access to your life, your secrets, your deep time, and your vulnerability.
The VIP section.
Exactly. And then the outer rings are for acquaintances, extended family, coworkers, etc.
It visualizes access. It forces you to actively decide who belongs in which circle, rather than just letting anyone with a loud voice or a demanding presence wander into your inner sanctum.
Like Uncle Bob.
Like Uncle Bob. You are the gatekeeper of your own energy.
And finally, to build what the text calls boundary muscle memory, there is the 21-day personal experiment.
This is where we put it into practice.
I absolutely love this, and I'd really challenge you, the listener, to do this today.
The premise is incredibly simple. You cannot rewrite decades of people-pleasing overnight.
You just can't.
So don't try.
Right. So step one, pick one small low-stakes boundary. Just one.
Just one.
Do not try to fix your toxic workplace, your difficult mother, and your marriage all on a Tuesday.
That is a recipe for a meltdown.
Pick something small. Maybe it's putting your phone on Do Not Disturb during dinner. Maybe it's just saying, I need to check my calendar, instead of automatically saying yes whenever someone asks for a favor.
Step two, stick to that one specific rule for 21 days straight.
Start small, build the muscle, and prove to your terrified nervous system that the world doesn't actually end when you hold a limit.
Right. People don't stop loving you just because you took an hour to respond to a text. This repetition is how your nervous system learns that you are actually safe with yourself. It builds profound self-trust.
Okay, let's take a breath and synthesize where we are.
Good idea.
We've grounded our nervous system with somatic tapping and handable boundaries.
Yeah.
We've journaled our values and defined our consequences.
Sure.
We know exactly what we want. But here is where the rubber actually meets the road.
The hardest part.
Once your boundary is defined internally, you have to actually look another human being in the eye and speak the words.
Yep.
And that is terrifying.
It is the moment of truth. And honestly, this is where most people fail.
Why do they fail?
Not because they lack courage, but because they use the completely wrong language. They confuse a boundary with a request.
Yes.
Dr. Gottman's research makes a brilliant, vital distinction here that we absolutely must explore.
Yes. The difference between making a request and setting a boundary. I want to spend some real time here because this is the difference maker.
It changes everything.
Let's role play this so it really sticks. I'm going to give you a scenario where I'm making a request, and I want you to analyze it and then turn it into a true boundary.
Let's do it.
Scenario one. I live with a roommate who constantly leaves a mountain of dirty dishes in the sink.
Classic roommate issue.
I'm super frustrated. I go to them and say, hey, could you please stop leaving your dirty dishes in the sink? It's really stressing me out, and I need you to clean up after yourself.
Okay, so that is a classic request.
It sounds totally reasonable, though.
It is reasonable, but you are asking someone else to change their behavior.
Right.
It is inherently collaborative, which is fine for healthy relationships, but it is also 100% unenforceable.
Oh, because I can't make them do it.
Right. You cannot control whether your roommate actually washes the dishes.
Right. And when they don't comply, like when I come home from work and the dishes are still there, I feel totally powerless, angry, and victimized.
Exactly. Because you tied your peace of mind entirely to their actions.
That makes sense.
A boundary, however, is a statement of what you will do. It requires zero cooperation from the other person.
Okay, so what's the boundary version?
The boundary version of that scenario sounds like this. I cannot cook in a messy kitchen. Going forward, I will only wash the dishes that I personally use. If the sink is full of your dishes when I need to make dinner, I will carefully move them to the counter so I can cook.
Wow. Notice the difference there. I am entirely in control of that outcome.
Yes.
I am simply stating the limit of what I will tolerate and the action I will take to protect that limit.
You don't need their permission.
Let's do another one, maybe a heavier one. Scenario two.
Okay.
My partner yells at me when they get stressed about work. I say, please stop raising your voice at me. You know it gives me anxiety when you yell.
Again, that is a request. You are basically pleading for them to regulate their own emotions, which you cannot control.
Right. I'm asking them to be calmer.
The boundary version shifts the locus of control back to you.
How does it sound?
It sounds like this. I will not stay in a room where I'm being yelled at. If voices are raised, I will leave the conversation and go for a walk until things calm down.
It takes all the begging right out of the equation.
Completely.
You aren't asking for permission to be treated well. You are stating the strict terms of your presence.
Exactly.
So how do we construct that sentence structurally in the moment? When our adrenaline is pumping. The sources provide a conversational framework for this called the SAFE method.
Right. SAFE.
Let's walk through it step by step.
The SAFE method is designed to keep you on track when your adrenaline is spiking.
Okay.
S stands for specify. You must pinpoint exactly what behavior is making you uncomfortable.
So be really specific.
Yes. You cannot be vague, and you definitely shouldn't use dramatic absolutes like you always do this or you never do that.
This just makes people defensive.
Exactly. Don't say you're stressing me out at work. Say, when you assign me extra projects on Friday afternoon without prior warning, I feel overwhelmed.
Be precise about the inciting incident.
Exactly. A stands for assert. Use clear, gentle, but firm words to express your boundary.
No wishy-washy language.
Right. No hesitation, no apologizing for your needs, no minimizing. Just say, I need you to check my capacity before signing weekend work.
Okay, what about the F?
F stands for fairness. This ensures the boundary is respectful of both parties and isn't just an aggressive ultimatum.
It acknowledges the relationship.
Right. It acknowledges shared goals. You say, I want to do great work for our team, and to ensure quality, I need to manage my workload effectively.
And E, which is undoubtedly the hardest part.
Oh, absolutely.
E stands for enforce. Make it a habit to actually remind others of the boundary when it is inevitably tested, utilizing those clear consequences we journaled about earlier.
You have to follow through.
Right. So you say, just a general reminder regarding my capacity. I won't be checking emails until Monday morning. I'll review this new project then.
Specify, assert, fairness, enforce. It takes the heated emotion entirely out of the confrontation and provides a clear, professional, and respectful structure.
I love how practical this is. But beyond frameworks, the sources also provide some incredible word-for-word scripts and tactical maneuvers to use in these moments.
Yes, the tactical stuff is great.
My absolute favorite is a tactic they call the information diet.
This is a really powerful concept. It stems from the realization that no is a complete sentence.
Let's validate the audience's anxiety here, though, because the information diet sounds great in a podcast, or excuse me, a deep dive studio.
Sure.
But let's be real. When you're standing in front of your mother-in-law and she's aggressively demanding to know why you aren't coming to Sunday dinner, giving a one-sentence no feels like stepping on a landmine.
It feels impossible.
Our instinct is to explain. We say, oh, I can't come to dinner because the baby has a slight cough and my car is making a weird noise and I have all this laundry to do and I'm just so tired.
And we do that because we think over-explaining will make them pity us and somehow validate our no.
Like we're submitting evidence to a judge.
Exactly. But therapeutically speaking, when you over-explain, you are actually inviting negotiation.
Right, really? Yes. You are giving the other person data points that they can use to dismantle your boundary.
Oh, man.
Yes.
Because what happens, that the mother-in-law says, oh, a cough is fine. I have medicine. And your father-in-law can look at your car while you're here. Just bring the laundry over here and do it at our house.
You're trapped.
You gave them the blueprints to bypass your wall.
Precisely. The information diet means starving the other person of ammunition.
Wow. Starving them of ammunition.
You provide the absolute minimum amount of context required to be polite.
So what does that sound like?
A simple, thank you so much for the invite. We'd love to see you soon, but we can't make it this Sunday.
That's it.
That's it. It is polite, it's warm, and it leaves absolutely zero room for argument.
But what if they push?
If they press and ask why, you just stay on the diet. You say, we just have other commitments this weekend.
It's bulletproof. It feels terrifying the first time you do it, but I can see how it's incredibly empowering.
It is.
Another great conversational tactic from the research is the broken record technique. This is highly useful when someone is actively pushing back, ignoring your information diet, or trying to draw you into an emotional argument about your boundary.
Like the people who just won't take no for an answer.
Exactly. Instead of getting derailed, getting defensive, or desperately trying to justify your reasoning.
What do?
You simply repeat your original statement calmly. Over and over.
Like a broken record.
Exactly. I understand you're disappointed, but I'm not available this weekend.
And if they push again, like they try to induce guilt, but family is supposed to be together.
You respond. I hear that's important to you, but like I said, I'm not available.
You remain a calm, unmovable rock.
You do not engage with their escalation.
So what does this all mean for different areas of our lives? Because setting a boundary with a demanding manager looks very different than setting one with a family member.
Context totally dictates the script. In a professional setting, boundaries almost always revolve around capacity, time, and intellectual respect. A highly effective script from the research for dealing with a demanding manager who, say, drops a massive project on your desk at 4:30 p.m. is this.
Okay, let's hear it.
I'd love to help the team with this project, but I don't currently have the capacity to take it on this week. If this is highly urgent, which of my current priorities should I deprioritize to make room for it?
Oh, that is so incredibly good.
It works so well.
Notice what you are doing there. You aren't acting like a stubborn teenager and saying, I won't do it.
Right.
You are actually forcing the manager to manage. You are forcing them to confront the physical reality of your finite time.
Exactly. You protect your boundary while remaining a collaborative, solutions-oriented professional.
Okay, so that's work.
Now contrast that with family boundaries, which are often heavily burdened by lifelong dynamics and deep emotional ties.
Let's go back to the cousin asking for money.
Right. The poorest boundary is just handing over the $500, knowing you'll never see it again, and seething with resentment for the next year.
The doormat.
The rigid boundary is blocking their phone entirely and refusing to ever speak to them again.
The fortress. So what's the healthy boundary?
The healthy boundary, utilizing the SAFE method and maintaining connection, sounds like this. I care about you immensely and I want to see you succeed, but I have a strict personal policy that I do not loan money to family.
Wow, okay.
However, I am more than happy to sit down with you this weekend and help you look over your budget to find some savings.
It's compassionate, but it's completely firm. You are holding a material boundary, but offering intellectual or emotional support.
Yes, you are keeping them in your roadmap.
So if we pull all of this together, this mountain of clinical research, the somatic tapping, the scripts, the theory.
All of it.
Setting boundaries is not about building fortress walls to isolate yourself from a scary world.
Not at all.
It is about drawing clear, respectful property lines. It's about protecting your peace, maintaining your own identity, and ultimately saying yes to yourself.
It really is.
By practicing somatic exercises to ground the nervous system, defining our values to eliminate guilt, and utilizing these structured scripts to stop over-explaining, absolutely anyone can rewrite decades of people-pleasing trauma.
It is a practice. It is just like going to the gym. It will be sore at first, but it takes time to build that muscle.
Right.
However, I do want to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought derived from the source material regarding the pushback you will inevitably face.
Because there will be pushback.
Guaranteed. When you begin to enforce healthy boundaries, when you finally stop being the accommodating doormat, some people in your life will undoubtedly get angry.
They won't like the new rules.
They won't. They might call you selfish. They might call you difficult. They might accuse you of changing.
Which is, frankly, the ultimate nightmare scenario for a recovering people pleaser. That's the exact rejection we are trying to avoid.
It is terrifying. But when that happens, when the guilt starts to creep in, I want you to ask yourself this one profound question.
Okay, what is it?
If someone becomes genuinely upset, angry, or distant simply because you set a healthy limit to protect your own physical or emotional well-being,
yeah,
does that mean you did something wrong? Or does it mean they were actively benefiting from your lack of boundaries?
Oh, wow. Let that sit for a second. Were they benefiting from your lack of boundaries?
That changes your whole perspective.
It really does. Let that perspective guide you as you reclaim your space and your energy. The people who truly value you, the ones who want to be inside your roadmap, will respect your property lines.
They absolutely will.
The ones who get angry at the new house rules. They were only there to raid the fridge.
Well said.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Start small, pick your 21-day experiment, build that boundary muscle memory, and remember, you don't have to build a fortress to feel safe. You just need a good roadmap.